Would you introduce yourself? And you could say that you're a writer or an old beatnik, but I would love it if you could pronounce a word that both you and I discovered, but you know French and I don't. A flaneur?
Flaneur.
Would you do that? Would you tell me that you're one?
Yeah. Okay. By popular request, I'm giving my name, which is Herbert Gold, and I'm a writer. And by popular request, I've been asked to pronounce, since I'm a great walker in cities, I'm a flaneur des deux rives, as they used to say, which means walking on both sides of the Seine, the two borders of the Seine. Or you could say it in English as a beatnik, French beatnik, said to me when I met her at City Lights Bookstore in North Beach. She was learning English from beatniks. And I said, "What are you doing in San Francisco?" And she said, "Digging the scene."
Digging the scene. I would like to know, because I wasn't able to find where it was in your life when you thought, "I really want to be a writer." So you dance around that a lot.
Yeah, no, I actually have written specifically about that. In fact, I'm going to give you, I put some paper over there, which I'll give you when you leave. I was standing at the water fountain in this either the fifth or sixth grade at Taft School in Lakewood, Ohio. And I just got an award in Lakewood, and I was back there. Anyway, I'd written a story called Endor. I liked to write before that, but Miss Collins was either the fifth or sixth grade teacher, and I was standing at the water fountain, and she stroked my hair, and she said, "Herbert, you're a really good writer." And the touch of a woman's hand, you know, even when you're
bingo
as old as I was then. And she said, but then she said, criticized this. She said it was a really good story. It was about a hermaphroditic earthworm. They are hermaphroditic.
Right.
Then she said, but you misspelled gruesome. I had spelled gruesome, G-R-E-W-S-O-M-E. But anyway, I think at that point, I used to tell stories to my younger brother. We had twin beds in the house where we lived in Lakewood. And so we told stories to each other. So I like telling stories. I was writing before that, but the idea of being a writer, I think, really came to me from Miss Collins.
I did read that you, in college, didn't write for the local college newspaper. But
yeah, I wrote for the literary magazine. I didn't write for the newspaper.
So what was your first byline that you got, that you remember?
The first byline... Well, I was the editor of the high school newspaper, and so and then that was my junior year, and then my senior year, the advisor, I later dedicated a book to him. He was really nice. Said, "Why don't you do a second year?" And I had a friend who wanted to be editor, so then I had a column in the Lakewood High Times, so I had a byline. But then I was writing poetry then, and I had a couple poems in an experimental magazine published in New York at the time. I think I wrote about this in Bohemia, called Experiment. And so when I went to college at Columbia, I called the editor of Experiment, and he invited me to a party. They didn't know I was 17 years old. And I met an old lady there who wanted to take me back to her houseboat. Her name was Anais Nin.
Are you serious?
And I did, of course, I'd never heard of her. I looked her up later to see how old she was then. I was 17. She was 38 then.
But ancient.
Ancient. And I started down. I thought, oh, here's some sex for me, even though she's an old lady. And I started down the stairs with her to go to her houseboat. And she spoke with this funny Azorean accent, Portuguese, made up, you know, it was an invented accent.
Yeah.
I think I talked about this with Henry Miller when I met him. And here I was, 17 years old, sweaty, horny, going back to her houseboat with her trellis and her vines growing as she's. And then she said to me on the stairs, we were going down, it was in Greenwich Village, and I was up living up in a dorm at Columbia, uptown. She said to me, you remind me of my father. I said, I've got a nickel here. I've got homework to do. That's so scary. It might have been a nickel. It was either a nickel or a dime. So I ran away from her.
That yeah.
was my only contact with a nice name. Yeah. So I was writing poetry then, and an editor who published some poems of mine in New Mexico Quarterly, I still remember his name, Alan Swallow, said you should be writing prose, and that kind of I always have written stories, but yeah. I still write poetry, but I don't publish it anymore.
Yeah,
I have a Mileta folder filled with poems that I write. My children will find it mm-hmm. when they excavate here.
So there you are, you're writing for the college paper, and you got
college magazine,
literary magazine,
yeah.
pardon me. And then you took off. You became a hobo.
Actually, not quite like that.
Uh-huh.
Before I graduated from high school early, and this was during the war. Instead of getting a job, which other people did, or going to start in college, I said to my parents, I want to travel. I want to hitchhike around the country. And if you were raised in Lakewood, Ohio, which is a suburb of the Paris of northeastern Ohio,
right.
Cleveland, I wanted to go to a real, a cosmopolitan center. So my idea at the age of 17 was, I'm going to go to Pittsburgh. I spent one day in Pittsburgh, and I realized, no, that's not what I was looking for.
Wrong world.
I spent only one day, then I went. Anyway, so I hitchhiked for about 6 months. I graduated mid-year, and then started Columbia in the fall. And I hitchhiked to California, to Los Angeles, San Francisco. It was winter time. I went to New York. I worked in a restaurant on the Lower East Side as a busboy. I was too young to be a waiter.
Yeah.
And lived in a hotel for $3 a week, which was a brothel, actually. But the tubercular coughing all night of the other bums.
Yeah.
I went to the Bowery. You could buy two stale donuts, and a cup of coffee. And fill the coffee with sugar. You think
right.
that was nourishing
right.
at that age.
Did you keep journals then?
Yeah, I did keep a journal.
Do you still have those?
Most of them not. I have one journal that I kept from later, but it was somewhat later from when I joined a carnival. I wrote a book called The Man Who Was Not With It, which is about
right.
carnival life.
Right.
And still, again, the publicity for this new book of mine says I was a carnival barker. I was never a carnival barker, but the paperback edition of The Man Who's Not With It, the book is written in the first person.
Yeah.
The paperback, one of the cheap paper, there are various paperbacks, trade paperbacks, and there was like a 35-cent paperback. It said, the true confessions, and so they made it seem as if it was a memoir
yeah.
or a story, which it wasn't. I did work at a carnival, but not as a barker. The other thing that happens if you read a book like Anna Karenina at a different age, it's a different book.
So one of the writers we spoke with said, every time you pick up a book, it's a different book.
That's right. That's what I read Anna Karenina three times, and the first time I read it when I was very young, and I loved the book, and I thought it was a great romance. Later, in middle age, I felt sorry for Karamazov.
Mm.
I mean, for... not for Karamazov. For Karenin, the jilted husband.
Yeah.
Because
he
was... when you read him young, he's boring, he's gray-faced, he doesn't answer her when she says she's, basically, when she says she's bored, and so he seems just like a dullard. Later, you realize he's just stunned with grief, and he doesn't know how to respond. And I think if you read it again, you see it's still a different. Now I see Vronsky as an idiot, the guy whom she fell in love with.
Okay, you were keeping journals, you're studying school, you're hanging out with the literati and the bohemian culture of Greenwich Village, and
at Columbia. Well, we were the only Jewish family in Lakewood, and so. And there was a great deal of anti-Semitism then. So I had friends. My best friend from kindergarten until 12 was someone, I talked about this in Lakewood when I just got an award. When he was 12 or 13, it was a birthday party. He loved my mother's oatmeal raisin cookies. And we went to each other's houses. I learned one phrase in German from his father, which I still remember: "Du bist ein Esel, you are a jackass." But then suddenly he had a birthday party, and I wasn't invited. He explained to me very soberly, as my friend, he said, "Well, my mother thought there were going to be girls there, and hormones are starting, and the girls' mothers wouldn't be happy with a Jew there." So I stopped being, I still remained kind of friends with him, but that friendship became dim. But so I'm talking about now junior high school, high school. I made friends with two eccentrics like me. One was named Bob Berryman, Robert Berryman, who became a psychologist and was a really lively man. And the other, Ted Brown, Theodore Brown, they became my close friends. And so even in Lakewood, Ohio, a staid suburb of Cleveland, there were eccentrics. You could call them bohemians. We stole alcohol from our parents, and we went camping, and we got drunk on mixtures of wine and vodka and gin and whatever else they had. And both of them had kind of difficult but bohemian lives. Neither one is alive now. There was another member of our group, I better not give his name, whom the other two, my two friends, thought was a genius. I'll say his first name, but in case somebody who knew him, his first name was Charles Chuck. The evidence that he was a genius was that he was not a virgin. We weren't sure that was true, but he said he was not a virgin, and he proved it to us. And so we hid in the bushes outside the house where his beloved did. We were probably 14 or 15. And he knocked on the door, and the person who had borrowed his virginity from him, opened the door. She had very long fingers, yellow fingers from the camels that she smoked.
Right.
She was a teacher we knew named Miss Winkleman.
Whoa.
And she grabbed him and pulled him into her house. And I turned to Ted and Bob and said, "Yep, Chuck is a genius." and of course, now she'd be called a child molester.
Yeah, but...
But the Army decided I had language aptitude,
right,
and they taught me Russian. And Bob Berryman married one of my Russian teachers after the war. She was a kind of sexy white Russian. I mean...
Yeah.
Older than he... Her name was Lita Swan, of all things.
Oh, no, that's made up. Come on.
No. Well, she might have made it up, but that was the name I knew her as.
Nice.
Lita Swan.
Okay, so how did you end up washing under the shores of San Francisco?
Well,
besides hitchhiking here.
First, I started writing I published some stories in national magazines when I was in college. The first one was in Harper's Bazaar, and they questioned the editor. What's her name? She was a very nice woman. She was worried that maybe I had plagiarized it. She maybe come to see her. I was a kid in college, and Harper's Bazaar published the story.
Big
so
time.
It was a big thrill.
Yeah,
and I published stories in the Columbia Review.
I have to interrupt.
Pardon?
What did you get paid for one of those articles in Harper's in those days? Do you remember?
Well, the story in Harper's Bazaar in 1940, whatever it was, 40, I guess it was after I came back from the war. Yeah, it had to be because I wasn't a freshman. So probably 46. What did I get paid? I don't remember. It was either $200 or $400. I'm not sure, actually. It was a lot of money.
Yeah.
A lot of money. But I published poems, poetry in the Columbia Review and stories, along with other of Columbia writers, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, Daniel Hoffman, John Hollander. It was a very literary generation. A man named Don Mankiewicz, who just died, who became a novelist but mainly a film writer. He was the nephew of the Mankiewicz who co-wrote Citizen Kane with.
Wow.
So anyway, so at Columbia there was, if you can imagine, I hung out at the West End with Allen Ginsberg, who was openly gay, which was not usual in those days.
Yeah.
Kerouac was bisexual, but not openly so. He was actually found in the maid at Hartley Hall or Livingston Hall found Kerouac and Allen in bed together one morning. It was a big scandal. And so...
Did you meet Neil Cassady?
I met Neil Cassady. I knew Neil Cassady later, yeah.
Okay.
Actually, I met him when I was...
Our youngest daughter's named Cassady.
I met his daughter.
No, our daughter
named
Cassady.
Oh, really? Really?
For several other reasons. Hopalong mainly.
Yeah.
But
the last time I saw... It's a digression. The last time I saw Neil Cassady before he died was at a pad rented by Ken Kesey, I think on Page Street, anyway, in the Haight area.
Yeah.
And I knew Ken pretty well, and we were friends, and we were walking around. There were a bunch of people sleeping. It was a beatnik pad.
Right.
And we were walking, and there was a parapet with a parrot sitting on it, with not a cage, but a nice old parrot.
Yeah.
And on the floor, sound asleep on the floor, I looked down, and on the floor, sleeping, was Neil Cassady. I said, "Oh, there's Neil." And he heard my voice, and he opened his eyes, and from a sound sleep, he said, Herb Gold, what's Herb Gold doing? How's Herb? Hi, Herb, hello. You know, went into complete speed rap instantly. And the reason I mentioned the parrot was he killed the parrot. The parrot dropped dead. I think the parrot wasn't used to anybody talking that fast. And Ken told me the parrot was 88 years old. You know, suddenly there was a plop, and there was a dead parrot on the floor.
Oh.
It fell off the parapet.
Do you know that Ken Kesey's widow married Larry McMurtry?
That's right. I knew that. I knew that Larry McMurtry when he was at... We met later, but I knew him when he was at Stanford.
Yeah.
He and... Kesey drove down to meet me. They could telephone and we met at what was it? That place across from Enrico's. You know,
The Hungry Eye.
No. Across from the Hungry Eye. No, not from the Hungry Eye. Was down the street.
Right.
Across on Broadway. It was a kind of short order place. I'll remember 3 in the morning.
Right, of course. Morning.
Anyway, and I got to, I became friendly with Larry McMurtry then. I haven't seen him now in many, many years, but we've exchanged a few letters over the years. And, but Kesey, because he was living here or in Palo Alto, I saw a lot of him.
The question I had was, you're pouring into San Francisco at a key point in history, and you're a writer at that point. You're doing magazine articles and...
Yeah, I published a number of books before I came here to live. I came here, I had hitchhiked here as a 17-year-old, and then at, toward the end of the war, the Army sent me to Camp Beale, which was not far from here, and we were going to be dropped. I was trained as a parachutist and also learned Russian, so we were going to be dropped behind the Soviet lines to help them use American equipment. Fortunately, we were called out one day in the morning. We were ready to be shipped to China. It was going to be in China.
Wow.
A big bomb had been dropped in Nagasaki, and the war might be over. Anyway, but while we were waiting to be shipped to China, I would come down to San Francisco and hang out with the Russians on Clement.
Yeah.
I picked up in a ballet school, I picked up a young woman, I don't remember her name, I looked for her when I came here to live. She would be an old, if she's still alive, she'd be a very old lady, because I was 20, 21. And I liked the town, but then when I finished, I went to Columbia, then I got a Fulbright, and I went to Paris. I love Paris. Mm-hmm. I wrote my first published book there. I had written a book-length manuscript, which was not published. It's in the possession of a library here now. I wrote a book, first novel, which I don't particularly love now. It was wonderful in one sense. It was published by Viking Press. It got good reviews. It made me officially a writer.
Right.
But I think it was before I really found my voice. It was the work of a bright graduate student. I was a graduate student in philosophy at the Sorbonne at that point. And so when the book was about to come out, Viking Press gave me a magnificent advance of $500. And I came back, I had a child born in Paris. And so I had the problem, what am I going to do to support my family while I write my next book? And so my family put pressure on me, and I didn't really know what else to do. Come back to Cleveland and make a life in Cleveland. The book was sent to Viking Press. It was published. I thought I'd come back and I'd go to the central post office in downtown Cleveland, and my picture would be on the 3-cent stamp.
Right.
But it wasn't.
Yeah.
And I was really scavenging to make a living. I worked as a night clerk in a hotel. I had a second child born there. So I had two daughters with my first wife. And I worked. I was the sole writer and editor of a weekly magazine called Where, What, When in Cleveland. There's a Where, What, When in San Francisco and in Detroit. It was a Detroit company that did it. I wrote it all on Sunday morning.
Right.
And I did a little part-time teaching also. But I really didn't want to stay in Cleveland, A, and B, I had two babies, and C, I had a wife, my first wife, who didn't really want to be a mother to those children, and 4, I was broke. So I went to the library and looked up a book called Scholarships and Fellowships, published, I think, by UNESCO, and I found something that I thought would be interesting and fun, and I spoke French by that time from my years in Paris, and so I applied for this grant. It was like a Fulbright to go to Haiti, and I fell in love with Haiti. I wandered a bit then, so I went back to New York. I lived in Port-au-Prince, in Paris, in Detroit, in Cleveland, in New York. Did I leave anything out? And then I applied for another grant later, 1959, I'd written a play, and I was offered a Rockefeller, I think it was a Rockefeller or Ford Fellowship, to do a play with the Jean Villard Theater in Avignon, because I speak French. But I couldn't go to Avignon for a year because I had two babies with my ex-wife. I wasn't going to leave them for a year. So I met Herb Blau and Jules Irving, who ran the Actors Workshop here. I don't know if you remember them.
No.
Probably before your time. They and so I was attached to the Actors Workshop here, which was a wonderful experience because I loved San Francisco. It was like being in Paris again. I was playing tennis one day, and I lifted the ball to serve, and I lifted my racket, I should have, and the sun was beating down on my face, and I thought, I'm getting sunburned. It's January 1st. I'm not going back to New York. I've been living there.
You're prolific. You're a prolific writer. And you
not
clearly,
prolific. I'm old. There's just a lot of
time. Well, there you go. How do you do your writing? When I called you, you said that you like to write in the morning, and my first thought was, like Thomas Mann. He probably on the clock, 6 days a week, 6 a.m. to noon.
No,
not like that at all.
No. I used to really work in the morning writing. I still work in the morning. I don't usually want to meet people in the morning. I don't like lunch either for the same reason. Kenneth Roberts said lunch is the enemy of the writer. Because you drink a little wine and that's the day. And one of the reasons I left New York wanted to leave New York to come to San Francisco is that there were too many distractions of that sort. It's very hard, even if you want to write in the morning, if someone calls you in the morning and says, Charlie Feldman wants you to go and work on a script of the first James Bond movie. It was called Casino Royale. And he'd like to meet us for lunch at the it wasn't Sardi's, but some chic restaurant in Midtown Manhattan. Well, it's very hard to say no to that, you know. And because I was a young writer on that scene, I was being invited to be on TV shows and interviews and there were parties and it was hard to write. So I left New York. I wanted to leave New York.
So how do you do your writing? Do you sit on this couch and write?
No, I sometimes go to cafes. I did a lot of writing in cafes in Paris. And I write usually by hand.
Yellow pads.
Or there's a typewriter in the other room. It's a Royal Standard.
Well, it's very evident to me that your original roots as a storyteller, not just a writer, but a storyteller, you're still a storyteller.
I like to tell stories. I think if you tell me I'm boring, I'll stop. But,
no.
But I do tell stories.
Yeah.
You know? I do. My son was filming me a lot. I think he's preparing for my funeral. And I would tell him some kind of interesting story. And he'd say, would you repeat that? Well, when I repeat it, it wouldn't be as interesting.
Course, you know? No, right.
Yeah.
Lacking the freshness.
But,
do you have, I mean, you must have wannabe writers, young folk that come to you for advice. They must come and say, what's the secret? What's the path? What's the magic word? What do you tell them?
Keep a journal. Write every day if you can. Keep a journal. You don't have to. I don't keep a journal. I have kept journals in the past. I have been keeping until recent years something I call urinal. At the end of the year, it's urinal, pronounced urinal. I sit here a couple days kind of summarizing the year for me. Actually, I stopped doing that last year or the year before.
Yeah.
writing begets writing. My son was here. He's finishing a new feature film, and he was on the phone, and I was waiting for him to get off, and I was sitting there, and I was sitting at, near my typewriter, and just looking at what I'd written that morning. That was yesterday. Looking at the morning, I started redoing it. You know, if you have something to work with,
yeah.
And then also, I think it's important for the writing to be something, for me, that you want to do. Don't think of this is something that will appeal to the New Yorker or Harper's.
Yeah.
I did publish a lot in Playboy, and Playboy they supported me for years.
Yeah.
And I'm still friendly with Hefner.
Oh.
I can tell you a little story about
one of Hefner. The best paying. One of the best paying writing.
Yeah, it was wonderful. Oh. And I had five children.
Yeah.
And two, well, eventually two ex-wives. So, and I don't live extravagantly, but I really. Anyway, but no, Playboy was really wonderfully helpful.
But you have a story.
I want to tell you about Hefner. I got a message, a phone call from the head of the Playboy Foundation saying, Hef is hurt because you don't come to visit him. He lives in Los Angeles.
Yeah.
And I go to Los Angeles. I have, my sons are both there now. And I like him. I didn't think he... I've always liked him and gotten along well with him. And when they had a lot of money, they would have the Playboy Writers Conclave. They'd bring us, several of the writers, to Chicago when Hef was living in Chicago, and to have fun, basically. I would be there with Kenneth Tynan and Nelson Algren, and, you know, it was strange,
yeah.
Funny group. And Hef was a good host, and he was always cordial to me, but I didn't think we are friends, it turns out. Anyway, so now I've taken to visiting him. About the time Pope Benedict resigned, you remember, because he felt he was too old.
Yeah.
The previous. Hef married a 25 or 26-year-old woman. Now, I'd met her at some of his parties, but I don't know which one she was, because there were always about 20 big-breasted blondes.
Right.
I couldn't figure out which. I knew he got married, but I didn't know which one. So he got married, and the Pope resigned. So I wrote him a note saying, congratulations, you know, the Pope isn't able to carry on his work at age 86 or whatever it is, but you at age 86 or 7 or 88, whatever he was, are able to get married again. He wrote me back just a one-line message. I have a better gig.
Classic.
Yeah. There's a documentary film about him, a couple documentary films. He did a lot of good things.
Yeah.
And this you could use also.
He changed the world.
During the Vietnam War, Playboy was the first national magazine that came out against the Vietnam War.
That's right.
And
it was in interviews that he did with significant anti-war major people that brought it to the attention.
And the Playboy Foundation supports freedom of speech issues. Anyway, I was involved with a group protesting the Vietnam War, and I wrote an ad we wanted to publish in the Sunday newspaper. At that time, there were two Sunday papers, The Examiner and The Chronicle.
Remember them well.
And it was an ad, you know, get out of Vietnam. That was the point. So I wrote or called Hef and said, would you like to contribute some money for this? And he said, I just wanted to do it in one of the papers. He said, how much would it cost? I told him. He said, how much would it cost for both papers? And I think at that time it was maybe $10,000, something like that. He wrote me a check for $10,000, and that's what it was. And I said, I'm going to make sure you get credit for this. I'm going to tell Herb Cain. He said, "Oh, don't do that. People think I'm a porn. You know, don't do that. That won't be good for the cause."
Yeah.
So he did. He gave me the money for that ad anonymously, and then a year or so later, I said to him, "Would you mind if I tell Herb Cain now?" And then he didn't. And then he was willing.
Right.
But he does a lot of. He's given a lot of money to good causes without claiming any credit at all.
You mentioned Herb Cain.
When I first got here, he was interested he coined the word beatnik, as you probably know.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
but
he invented the word
beatnik.
It was the time of Sputnik. By analogy with Sputnik, he invented the word beatnik.
Wow.
If you look it up, I think dictionary slang.
I believe that rings the bell. Yeah.
I want to know what books inspired you as a young person, and what books you read now.
What books inspired me as a young person?
Were there any that were particular?
Well, as a child, Tarzan and Little Women. And Black Beauty. I remember I read Black Beauty several times. I cried at the death of the horse.
Yeah.
And then
Mary
later
Rains.
In France, I ate horse meat, but I was older. After the war, there was a shortage of meat. Actually, the French like boucherie chevaline, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, Dickens, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Thomas Wolfe, of course.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, a writer you may not have heard of, probably did me a lot of damage, but I loved him in high school. Two writers, actually. One, James Branch Cabell. He wrote a book called Jurgen, and it's a sort of medieval romance. He was a Southern writer, and then he wrote a trilogy called Smert. Three books: Smert, Smith, and Smire. And then a book which influenced me a lot, because written by a Nazi anti-Semite spy named George Sylvester Viereck, called My First 2,000 Years. And I echoed that. I wrote a memoir at the age of 40,
right,
called My Last Two... Called, his was called... No, his was called My Last 2,000 Years. I called mine My First 2,000... I met him, actually, when he got out of prison. He was in prison during World War II as a Nazi agent. And it was an anti-Semitic book, but he said that Jews... And I was reading this as a 17-year-old. The Jews have the secret of unendurable pleasure indefinitely prolonged. And I hope that's for me.
Mr. Gold, thank you ever so much.
Mr. Mason, thank you.
This has been a hoot.
You have that. Yeah.
Yeah.